She laughed and then bit her lower lip to stop herself. "Don't do that," she protested. "Don't make me laugh. I need a loo. My condition is critical." "Ah, so that is where you were headed when Prince Charming fell in love with you." "I warned you, don't do that." With an effort, she smothered her giggle, and he took pity on her. "There is a public loo at the gate to the park. Can you make it that far?" "I don't know." "The alternative is the rhododendrons." "No thanks, no more public performances today." "Let's go, then." He took her arm. They skirted the serpentine, and Ramon glanced back. "Your boyfriend's ardour must have cooled," he said. "No sign of him. What a fickle fellow." "Pity. I love to watch you do that trick of yours again. How much further is it?" "Here it is." They had reached the gate, and she dropped his arm and started for the small red brick building that nestled discreetly in the shrubbery beside the path. But at the door she hesitated. "My name is Isabella. Isabella Courtney. But my friends call me Bella," she said over her shoulder, and darted through the doorway. "Yes," he murmured softly. "I know." Even while she was in the cubicle she could hear the music, barely muted by the distance and the brick walls, and then the clatter of a helicopter passing low over the roof. But it was unimportant. She was thinking about Ramon. At the wash basin she studied herself in the mirror. Her hair was a mess. She tidied it quickly. Ramon's hair was thick and dark and wavy. He wore it long, but not too long. She wiped off her pale pink lipstick on a Kleenex and then repainted her mouth. Ramon's mouth was full but masculine, soft but strong. She wondered how it would taste. She dropped the lipstick back into her bag and leant close to the mirror to appraise her own eyes. They didn't need drops. The whites were so clear they had a bluish sheen, like those of a healthy baby. She knew her eyes were her best feature, that Courtney blue, something between cornflower and sapphire. Ramon's eyes were green. They were the first thing that had struck her about him. That clear, startling green, beautiful, but... she searched for the adjective. Beautiful, but deadly, that was it, exactly. She didn't need the demonstration that had felled the Hell's Angel. One look at those eyes, and she had known he was a dangerous man. She felt the back of her neck prickle with a delicious thrill of fear and of anticipation. Perhaps this was the one, at last. Beside his image, all the others seemed to pale and fade. Perhaps this was the one she had searched for so long. "Ramon de Santiago y Machado," she said in a throaty purr, savouring the taste of it in her mouth, watching her own lips form the words. Then she straightened up and turned to the doorway. She prevented herself from hurrying. Slowly, languidly, on the tall stiletto heels that made her hips roll as she walked, and her bottom swing like a metronome, lace flashing under the abbreviated skirt, she went to the door. She pouted slightly and let her long, thick eyelashes droop over the blue as she stepped out into the slanting golden sunlight. And she stopped dead. He was gone. She caught her breath and felt the cold, quick slide of her stomach as though she had swallowed a stone. She looked around her in disbelief. "Ramon," she said uncertainly, and ran into the pathway. There were hundreds of others coming down the tarmac path towards her, the first escapees from the concert trying to avoid the human avalanche that would soon follow. But none of them was the elegant figure she sought. "Ramon," she said, and hurried to the park gates. The traffic boomed down the Bayswater Road, and she looked frantically right and left. She was overcome with a sense of disbelief. He had gone and left her. It was beyond her experience. She had shown him that she wanted him. She couldn't possibly have made it plainer. And he had walked away. Her next emotion was outrage. Nobody did that to Isabella Courtney, not ever. She felt slighted and insulted and very angry. "Damn him," she said. "Damn the man." Her anger lasted only seconds, and then it slumped. She felt lost and bereft. It was an alien sensation for her. "He can't just leave like that," she said aloud, and recognized in her own voice the self-pitying whine of a spoilt child. So she said it again, differently, trying to recapture her anger, but it was unconvincing. Behind her, she heard a shout of raucous laughter, and she glanced back. A bunch of Hell's Angels was swaggering down the pathway, still 100 yards away, but coming directly towards her. She couldn't remain here. The concert was over. The crowds were breaking up. The helicopter she had heard must have come up to pick up Jagger and his Rolling Stones. There was little chance of her rejoining her friends now. They'd be lost in the multitude. She looked around her just once more, swiftly but despairingly. Still no sign of that dark, wavy head of hair. She tossed her own head and lifted her chin. "Who needs him anyway, damn Dago?" she muttered furiously, and struck out down the pavement. Behind her there was a chorus of whistles and catcalls, and someone, one of the angels, began calling the step for her. "Left, right, left, shake, rattle and roll." She knew that her high heels were making her bottom waggle furiously. She hopped on one foot and then the other as she pulled off her shoes and then fled barefoot down the pavement. She had left her car at the embassy car park in the Strand, so she had to take the tube from Lancaster Gate Station to reach it. Her car was a brand new Mini Cooper, the very latest 1969 model. Daddy had given it to her for her birthday, and had had it customized for her by the same body shop that had done Anthony Armstrong Jones's Mini. They had souped up its engine, upholstered it in white Connolly leather like a Rolls, and resprayed it the same glitter silver as Daddy's new Aston Martin, with her initials in gold leaf on the door. All the swinging set were driving Minis. There were more of them than Rolls's or Bentley's parked outside Annabelle's on a Saturday night. Bella threw her shoes into the tiny back seat and revved the engine until the needle went into the red. The tyres squealed and left black smears on the ramp of the car park. As she glanced back at them in the rearview mirror, it gave her a dark, satanic pleasure. She drove with abandon, protected from the wrath of the Metropolitan Police by her diplomatic plates. She wasn't really entitled to them, but Daddy had wangled them for her. She beat her own record back to Highfield, the ambassador's residence in Chelsea, and Daddy's official Bentley with its pennants on the wings was parked at the entrance, and Clonky, the chauffeur, grinned and saluted her. Daddy had brought most of his own staff from Cape Town. Bella controlled her mood long enough to give Clonky her sweetest smile and toss him the keys. "Put my car away for me, there's a dear Clonky." Daddy was tremendously strict about the way she treated the servants. She could take her moods out on anyone but them. "They're part of the family, Bella," and most of them had indeed been at Feltafriden, the family home at the Cape of Good Hope, since before she was born. Daddy was at his desk in his study on the ground floor, overlooking the garden. He had discarded his coat and tie, and the desktop was piled with official documents, but he tossed down his pen and swiveled his chair towards her as she came in. His face lit up at the sight of her. Bella dropped into his lap and kissed him. "God," she murmured, "you're the most beautiful man in the world." "Far be it from me to question your good judgment," Shaza Courtney smiled, "but may I ask what has brought this on?"
"Men are either bores or bores," she said, "all except you, of course."
"Ah, and what has young Roger done to arouse your ire? To me he seems fairly inoffensive, if not actually insipid." Roger was the one who had escorted her to the concert. She had left him on the crowded lawn in front of the stage, but now it took her a moment to remember him.
"I'm off men for life," Isabella declared. "I shall probably hie me to a nunnery."
"Could you possibly eschew holy orders at least until tomorrow?" "I do need a hostess for dinner this evening, and we haven't yet arranged the seating."
"All done long ago," she said, "before I left for the concert."
"The menu?"
"Chef and I settled that last Friday. Don't panic, Papa. All your favourites, Coquille Saint-Jacques and lamb from Cam de Boue."
Shaza served only lamb reared on his own farms in the Karoo. The desert scrub gave the flesh a distinctive herby flavour. All the embassy beef came from his extensive ranches in Rhodesia, and the wines from the vineyards of Veltefrieden, where for the last 20 years Shaza's German winemaker had laboured with rare skill and dedication to raise the quality of the vintage to the point where now Shaza would back it against nearly any of the second crews of Burgundy. His ambition was still to make a wine that would compare with some of the great and noble houses of the Côte d'Or. When it came to transporting this fare from the Cape of Good Hope to London, Courtney Shipping Lines ran a weekly refrigerated vessel on the Atlantic route. "And I picked up your dinner jacket from the cleaners this morning, and I had Buds in Piccadilly Arcade make you 3 more dress shirts and 12 new eye patches. Your others were all getting so tatty I've thrown them out." Still sitting in his lap, she adjusted his eye patch. Shaza had lost his left eye flying Hurricanes against the Italians in Abyssinia during the Second World War. The black silk eye patch gave him a dashing, piratical air. Now Shaza smiled complacently. When he had first invited Bella to come to London with him, she had only recently turned 21 years of age, and he had thought long and hard before foisting the onerous task of official embassy hostess onto one so young. He need not have worried. After all, she had been trained by her grandmother, added to which they had brought the chef and butler and half the staff from the Cape with them. So she started with her own highly trained team. In 3 years, Isabella had built up a reputation in the diplomatic circle, and her invitations were sought after, except by those whose embassies no longer maintained relations with South Africa. "Do you want me to cover for you while you sneak off with your Israeli pal for half an hour after dinner to build an atom bomb?" "Bella," Shaza frowned quickly, "you know I don't like remarks like that."
"Joke, Daddy. There's nobody here to hear us."
"Even in private and in fun, Bella." Shaza shook his head severely. That had been uncomfortably close to the truth. The Israeli military attaché and Shaza had been involved in a courtship dance for almost a year now, and they had gone far beyond the stage of flirtation already. She kissed him, and his expression softened. "I must go and bath."
She stood up from his lap. "The invitations are at 8:30. I'll come and do your tie for you at 10 past.
Shaza had tied his own bow for 40 years, until Isabella had decided that he was incapable of doing it. Shaza's eyes dropped to her legs. "If your skirts get any shorter, mademoiselle, your belly button will be winking at the moon."
"You really must try not to be an old fogey. It's most unbecoming in one of the swingingest papas in the 20th century.
She headed for the door, deliberately accentuating the movement of her lower body under the offending article of clothing, and Shaza sighed as the door closed. "That's a load of dynamite with a very short fuse," he murmured. "Perhaps in a way it's a good thing that we're going home."
In September, Shaza's 3-year ambassadorial stint would be up. Isabella would once more go under the control and discipline of Santon Courtney Malcolmes, her grandmother.
Shaza realized that his own efforts in that direction had been less than totally successful, and he would hand over the responsibility with relief. Thinking of their imminent return to Cape Town, Shaza glanced back at the papers on his desk. The years in the London embassy had been a political penance for him. When the Prime Minister, Hendrik Verwoerd, had been assassinated in 1966, Shaza had made a serious miscalculation and backed the wrong man to succeed the premiership. The result of that mistake had been that once John Forster had become Prime Minister, Shaza had been shunted into this political backwater. But, as so many times before, he had turned disaster into triumph. Using all his gifts and natural abilities, his shrewd business acumen, his presence and good looks, his charm and powers of persuasion, he had done much to deflect from his homeland the building wrath and contempt of the world, particularly that of Britain's Labour government and her Commonwealth, most of whose members were nations headed by black or Asian premiers. John Forster had taken these achievements into account. Before leaving South Africa, Shaza had been intimately concerned with Arms Corps, and Forster had offered him the job of chairman of Arms Corps on his return home.